Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm David Reed. Zambia is one of the world's richest nations, as long as you measure wealth by natural resources. The country in South Central Africa is the continent's biggest copper producer. Mining companies have extracted nearly $30 billion worth of copper from Zambia in the past 10 years, a period of high prices for the metal. So why is Zambia still one of the world's poorest nations, with high unemployment and 64% of the people living in poverty? The answer, in part, is that Zambia privatized its mines 10 years ago to pay off part of its staggering debt. Now the mines are owned by multinational companies, and those foreign investors have managed to avoid paying taxes on their profits. However, in recent months, the relatively new government has stepped up its efforts to force the mining companies to pay their fair share of taxes. But there's a downside. The companies are threatening to cut thousands of jobs. On our program today, we'll talk to a Bloomberg News correspondent in Zambia's capital who's been covering this simmering conflict, an unfortunately typical African story. But first, World Watch, our summary of international news with Raymond Tungekar.
Tensions have emerged between Indonesia and Australia after leaked documents reveal that Australia attempted to spy on Indonesian President Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono and other senior officials. The allegations are based on files leaked by former NSA contractor Edward Snowden. Indonesia's president said that relations between the two countries have been damaged by the reports. Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott did not apologize, but expressed regret. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said violence in the Central African Republic is at risk of spiraling out of control. He warned that military groups are turning Christians and Muslims against each other. The Central African Republic has been in turmoil since a rebel alliance ousted the country's president in March and replaced him with a rebel commander. Protests turned violent on Monday as thousands of people took to the streets of Haiti to demand the resignation of President Michel Martelly. At least one person was shot during the demonstrations, which were the largest against Martelly since he took office in 2011. The march was held on the anniversary of the final battle in Haiti's struggle to abolish slavery and establish independence. A representative of the United Nations peacekeeping mission in the country said violence has been mounting. And that's it for World Watch.
Danish filmmaker Christopher Gulbrandsen went to Zambia to film a documentary that tries to answer the question about why the country's booming copper prices have not reduced poverty. Here's a clip from his recent documentary called Stealing Africa. The first person speaking is the Minister of Mines in Zambia, followed by a lecturer on African politics at Cambridge University, and then Zambia's finance minister during mining privatization.
As a country, as a nation, God has blessed us with such an abundant natural resource. Now, the paradox is that Zambia is ranked among the bottom 20 poorest countries in terms of poverty. We are wealthy, yet we are poor.
The mines was the last great resource that the state held.
Zambia made a decision that the country was in such a desperate situation with its very high debt
for the mines to be privatized.
The bank's assumption was that if you can attract foreign investment, eventually the benefits will trickle down.
The mining company was like a mother. Parting with that asset was like cutting the breast from a mother.
Matthew Hill covers Zambia for Bloomberg News and joins us by telephone from Lusaka, the capital and largest city. With us in the studio is Andrew Fritz, who was a Peace Corps volunteer in Zambia and now is a master's student here at MU. Welcome to Global Journalist.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here.
Let's talk first about Zambia. Matt, could you kind of describe geographically where Zambia is?
Yeah, sure. It's a country, a landlocked country in South Central Africa, surrounded by DRC to the north, Angola to the west, Mozambique and Malawi to the east, and Tanzania and then Botswana and Namibia and Zimbabwe to the south.
And Andrew, talk about the natural resources and what it was like to live in Zambia.
Well, there's an abundance of natural resources there. Of course, you know, as we're talking about mining, there is a lot of extractive resource production taking place in the country. Not only copper, but manganese and several other types of minerals. But there's an abundance of resources as far as agriculture. It's a prime location for agriculture in sub-Saharan Africa.
You mentioned before about its potential for agriculture, the industry.
Yeah. Actually, Zambia, one of the things I learned while I was there, I had the opportunity to work with a lot of people in the Ministry of Agriculture. And something I was told was that because of the fertility of the land and the potential, Zambia has the capability, if agricultural production is ramped up in the way it needs to be, to feed the entire rest of the continent because of how fertile that ground is.
Matthew, so why is Zambia so dependent on copper?
Well, it's just always been the case, going back to the colonial days when the country was renamed or named as a Northern Rhodesia. Cecil John Rhodes, the British imperialist and businessman, played a major role in building the copper rail, the railway up to the copper mines in the north of the country. And I guess since then, it's always just been the mainstay of the economy. For example, the country depends on copper for about 75% of its export earnings at the moment.
And let's talk about the mines. Andrew, you visited a copper mine when you were in Zambia. Could you describe it?
Well, it was a very large-scale production, an open-pit mine, and it was unlike anything I'd ever seen in my life. I mean, it looked like a moonscape to some degree. Mm-hmm. Kind of what you would expect as far as looking at a typical mining operation, a lot of heavy equipment. One of the things I did notice, however, was that there didn't seem to be a lot of people wearing what I would consider mm-hmm. safety gear for doing such kinds of operations.
And there has also been an environmental impact from
absolutely,
mines like that.
Absolutely. In fact, one of the figures that I read not too long ago, actually when I was living in Zambia, was that Kabwe, which is one of the cities within the copper belt, is either the second or third most polluted city on the planet because of groundwater issues, which directly is a result of mining.
And Matthew, what do average Zambians think about the copper mining industry, which does, of course, provide many, many jobs in the country?
Well, if you ask the first person you see in Zambia what they think about the mining industry, almost invariably you'll get an answer that says that they're very suspicious of the mines. They don't think that they're paying enough tax. Overwhelming sense of distrust.
Mm-hmm. And is that Andrew, how they've talked with you about?
Very much so. Something else that I heard a lot was that they were quite upset with the way the mines operate because of the fact that they literally extract the raw materials and ship them overseas. There's no actual production of anything involving copper within the country. It's just extracting resources and shipping it to another country.
And Matthew, can you explain a bit about the history, maybe a rough outline of the history of copper mining in Zambia as far as perhaps starting with a decade ago with privatization?
Copper mining in Zambia started in earnest in the early 1900s. The mines were privatized under the country's first president, Kenneth Kaunda. That was in the 70s. Copper production peaked in the early 70s at around 750,000 tons per year. And then after privatization, production gradually fell till the start. This is nationalization. Under nationalization, production gradually fell to about 200 to 250,000 tons of copper a year when the mines started being privatized. Since then, production has increased quite rapidly. A lot of the companies have invested billions of dollars into building production, and as things stand now, production's back above where it was at its peak.
So let's go back 10 years then describe what was happening in Zambia. You mentioned that the mines were not being run very well and their production had gone way down. And yeah. I understand the country's debt had gone way up and they were in a sort of a desperate situation. Could you bring us back to that point in time?
Basically, things went really pear-shaped eventually under nationalization. I mean, that was part because the mines were being run very inefficiently. They were very labor-heavy. The mines supported entire towns. I mean, that goes right down to the mines would run the healthcare. It was a very socialistic situation. And basically, in the end game, the mines were costing the country, or were costing the government, about $1 million a day. The copper price had also fallen. There was a lot of excess supply in the world at that time, so that didn't help matters.
Yeah.
So basically, the government ended up with a debt to GDP ratio of about 200%.
And they went to the International Monetary Fund and World Bank, and said we need more loans. And they said, well, one way to do that would be to privatize the mines. Is that how it went down?
Yeah, that's how I understand it. There was a condition of accessing more loans and getting debt canceled was to agree to privatize the mining industry. And I guess they couldn't have really chosen worse timing to do it, because in the late 90s, when most of the mines were privatized, that's when the Chinese economy was really starting to take off, and the world was about to see the biggest resource boom it ever has. And of course, metal prices soared after that.
Mm-hmm. And Zambia, I understand, ended up getting a pretty bad deal as far as the amount of money they got and the taxing structure.
Yeah, I suppose whenever you're signing any sort of commercial agreement, you look at the environment at the time when it's being signed. It's simple economics, I guess. Nobody really knows what sort of agreements they did sign with the private mining companies, so-called development agreements, because those have been kept quite secret. For example, the power tariffs that the mines pay, according to the power supply companies, are way below what it costs the power companies to produce that power, and that's a result of the development agreements that were signed as part of privatization.
And since privatization, what have previous presidents done about taxes on mining profits?
Well, I mean, it's a very politically contentious issue. There's a lot of pressure from various areas of the population to increase the tax take that the mining companies pay. Various governments have endeavored to do so by trying to introduce things like windfall taxes, which instead of taxing the companies at the bottom line, the profit, it taxes the companies at the top line, the revenue that they're selling their copper for. Most of those efforts have failed because the development agreements are legally binding agreements that cover things such as taxation levels.
And my understanding from the documentary was that one president started to aggressively act on this and he died, and then the subsequent president kind of decided to side with take the mining company's position. And then the current president was elected 2 years ago. Can you bring us tell us a bit about the new administration?
Yeah, sure. In various election campaigns before the current president, Michael Sutter had promised to bring back the windfall tax. He's decided now that he came into power, he's decided that wasn't necessarily the best way to go about things. And rather, the current government has put a much stronger emphasis on making sure that the mining companies are not avoiding tax and that they are paying what is due to the government. They've clamped down quite strongly on monitoring exactly what the companies are exporting, how much they're getting paid for that, and all the money that all the revenue that they do receive for the sale of their goods has to come back into Zambia within 120 days, so the government can monitor exactly how much money they are earning and tax them accordingly.
And what's been the reaction of the mining companies?
Well, I think that initially there was quite a pushback against that. The mining companies took issue with many, I guess, they said that essentially the devil's in the detail. They took issue with a lot of the nitty-gritty of that legislation that the government introduced. That law was actually supposed to come into place, well, come into effect on May 15 after a lot of pushback from the private sector, especially the mines. The government actually agreed to re-look at the legislation. They made a few minor changes, and that actually ended up only coming into effect on July 1st.
Okay. Other documentaries show that the privatization of mining, the mining industry, is to blame for a lot of the problems in Zambia. But in one of your reports, the government said it's looking into further privatization. How can you explain that this move?
Well, I think the notion that a lot of the problems are because of privatization itself is not necessarily accurate. I mean, the government realizes that what a mess the economy's finances were in because of nationalization. And I don't think that they want to go back to that situation. And I mean, also a lot of, I guess, what the Chamber of Mines, the representative of all the mining companies, says is that a lot of the reason why the mines haven't been paying as much tax as perhaps the population would like is because they're allowed to deduct the capital, the money that they spend on expanding their operations and investing in what were pretty dilapidated mines for the bigger, older companies. They're allowed to deduct that from their tax, which, I mean, for example, Vedanta Resources, which is listed on the London Stock Exchange, they say that they've invested over $2 billion, $2.4 billion, I think is the figure. So they're yet to reap the profit benefit of that investment. And that's what's going to come through. The Chamber of Mines says that's what's going to come through in the next couple of years, and the government will be getting a lot more tax payments from the mines.
Okay. Now, I want to get into the current state of the economy, but before we continue our discussion, I want to remind everyone that you can view or listen to this program anytime by downloading our podcasts at globaljournalist.org. You also can find interesting articles, photos, and interviews related to our program on our website. This week, our site features articles on environmental and health issues in the Zambian Copper Belt and on Glencore, the leading exporter of Zambia's copper. Please send us questions or comments via globaljournalist@kbi.org or our Facebook page. You could also follow us on Twitter at globaljourn. Let's step back a bit about and get Andrew back into the conversation. In the 3 years that you were in Zambia, how did things change over that time?
Well, I'd say you noticed a lot of changes as far as social capital. You have these large organizations who employed a lot of people who very largely came from rural populations. And because of the extra income that was being provided to these workers, they were able to bring that back into their communities, which you would see increasing the social capital within these rural communities in just amazing ways. You know, so even small things as far as just providing a little extra food security for a family.
Matt, how would you describe how things have progressed in the time that you've been keeping an eye on Zambia and covering the issues there?
Well, definitely. I mean, if you drive around town as a hell of a lot of development going on everywhere. That much is obvious. New shopping malls being built all over the capital, Lusaka, hotels springing up. There's a lot of development happening, that's for sure. I mean, the country's economy has been growing at an average of about 6% over the past few years. The problem is that development and growth has really been centered around the mines, which are up in the north of the country, the northwest of the country, and then the capital, Lusaka. If you go out into the villages where I suppose you could say the majority of the population live, the development hasn't really trickled down to those people.
Let's talk about the Chinese investments. When you were there, you noticed more investments being made by China. Definitely, yeah. There seemed to be quite an insurgence of Chinese occupation as far as ownership of mines, and not only mines but other industries as well within the country, and that presented some interesting situations at times.
Matt, what's your impression of increase in Chinese investment?
Oh, yeah, there's definitely been a massive influx of Chinese investment into Zambia. You get a wide variety of Chinese investors. You can't paint them all with the same brush. For example, you'll get a guy who just owns a small chicken farm or a brick making factory, making bricks by hand. And I mean, that on the other side of the spectrum, you've got hundreds of millions of dollars copper mines, which are owned by some of the biggest Chinese mining companies, such as Jinchuan. Mm-hmm. There has been some conflict between Chinese investors and Zambian workers. For example, there was a mine in the south of the country, a coal mine called Colum, where there were numerous instances of violence between the Chinese management and the Zambian workers. It ended up with workers being shot at, with a Chinese manager being killed, and ultimately the government canceling the company's mining license.
Okay, and just as sort of a final comment, could you talk to us about what your personal feelings are about just a few of the biggest challenges the country faces and where you see it going in the next year?
Well, I think the challenge that the government faces at the moment is the tension between getting more investment into the mines and other parts of the economy, which the country desperately needs. Mm-hmm. And then also making sure that they optimize the amount of tax and revenue that they're getting out of these investments. Obviously, the world economy is going through a bit of a difficult phase. So it's always difficult to strike a balance between those two factors. And I think that's something that the government is trying to do, but it's a very difficult thing to get right.
Andrew, your final thoughts on the future of Zambia based on your experience?
Well, I'd say based on my experience, there is massive potential for growth, and you're starting to see that growth really take shape. Mm-hmm. So just like many other sub-Saharan countries, I think what you're going to find in the future that industry and agriculture and all the things which are really going to build up that country are going to continue to happen, and I'd say it's going to be a successful country in the future.
Okay. Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for being on the show today and offering us this insight into Zambia.
Thank you.
Global Journalist is produced by the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Our guests today were Matthew Hill from Bloomberg News and Peace Corps volunteer Andrew Fritz. Global Journalist is directed by Travis McMillan, audio by Pat Akers. Raymond Tungakar is our executive producer. John O'Connor was this week's lead producer. Please stay tuned for a special report from Global Journalist producer Casey Morrell. And join us again next week for another Global Journalist. I'm David Reed.
The 9th of November is an important day in German history, for both highs and lows. It's the day the Berlin Wall fell in 1989, and it's the day the German states became a republic in 1918, before the end of World War I. Global journalist producer Casey Morell was in Berlin on the 9th, and has this report on what the city did to commemorate one of German history's darker times.
Berliners reflected on the historical events of November 9th in many different ways. While scores gathered near the Brandenburg Gate to celebrate the fall of the wall and the eventual reunification of Germany, a quieter commemoration occurred across town near the Zoologischer Garten. November 9th is the anniversary of Kristallnacht, the night of broken glass. On that night in 1938, the Nazis led riots through the cities of Germany. Jewish-owned businesses were ransacked, their storefronts defaced with graffiti, their windows smashed in. Nearly 30,000 Jews were arrested that night alone and sent to concentration camps throughout the Reich. Historians widely consider Kristallnacht to be one of the first major events in the run-up to the Holocaust. Crowds gathered in the Kaiser Wilhelm Gedächtniskirche, a church that was partially destroyed in the Second World War and rebuilt during the 1960s, to hear a classical choral concert from the Tilburg Festival Orchestra and the Philharmonic Choir Tyn Kunst Rotterdam. The program included Michael Tippett's A Child of Our Time, an oratorio written during World War II to specifically commemorate Kristallnacht. Other remembrances took place throughout Berlin. Stores along Unten den Linden in downtown Berlin placed decals over their windows to make them look like they were smashed in. A march through affected parts of the city took place earlier in the day as well. Ariane Pohls is a German artist who's lived in Berlin for more than a decade. She says both Berlin and Germany as a whole are very mindful of what's happened in the past, and that such remembrance starts from a young age.
Ich bin so aufgewachsen, dass ich das gar nicht in Frage gestellt habe.
I grew up in such a way that I never even questioned it. It was clear from the very beginning that you have to set yourself apart from your story and that you must carry a particular type of responsibility, which now, in retrospect, I would not see the same way. I don't believe Germany needs to do more, but instead, maybe do it differently. It is basically an integral part of our society that we are aware of the past, but we must also take steps towards another way of remembering, a way to get around doing a memorial one right after the other. It is a strong statement, but there is a danger that, especially in Berlin, the message will be relativized across the multitude of memories and constructed remembrances.
When I asked what she meant by that, Pohls responded in English.
It might keep people from reflecting and thinking about it, but then with the memorial for the murdered Jews, for example, it's meant to spend time in there and experience it, so you have time to contemplate. It's not just a sculpture you stand before and read the information and then that's it.
Others, like American journalist Rachel Witte, who is also in Berlin for the commemoration, think that Germany's efforts to remember its history are sometimes as subtle as not knocking down old buildings.
You walk around the cities and you see that it's there. There's constant reminders, you know, from the Soviet-style architecture that still permeates a lot of East Berlin to the Berlin Wall Memorial. The history is there, and there's no denying it. And I think today, Germany has reached a point where it is, you know, embracing its history and moving forward. And so now the cities kind of have this duality about them, which I think is just entirely fascinating.
With its memorials to the different groups murdered during the Holocaust, its tributes to the Berlin Wall, and its museums detailing abuses by the East German State Security Forces, or Stasi, Berlin reflects a nationwide effort not just to preserve the past, but to keep it in the back of the collective consciousness. The efforts to mark Kristallnacht were no exception. For Global Journalist, I'm Casey Morell in Berlin.